Did you know that a family, probably very much like your family, once spent years with the visitors in their everyday lives? I'm not talking about downloads or magical experiences. I'm talking about daily life. That was my family, my wife Anne and our son, at our cabin in upstate New York many years ago. I wrote a book about it, two books, Transformation and then Breakthrough, that are a diary of those extraordinary days. When Transformation was published, the media was ready for us. They beat the book to death. They made sure it sold very few copies. In fact, you probably haven't read Transformation or Breakthrough. You probably never heard of them. But they remain an absolutely unique chronicle. Now, what I've done, since I think that many more ordinary families are going to be experiencing life with these visitors sooner or later, is that I have updated Transformation. And I'm calling it Transformation 2025. It brings together all of our new knowledge of them, of our own minds, of our brains, of how the interaction works, all of it. It's absolutely unique in the world. Transformation 2025 will be out on December the 15th on Kindle, shortly after that in hardcover and softcover, and an audiobook read by me. Transformation 2025. Don't miss this. As we get closer to disclosure, we get also closer to contact. I've done this. Anne did it. Our son did it. It's perfectly possible. It's not easy. But what an adventure Transformation and Breakthrough are. And the adventure continues. And it will continue soon in many more lives. I think. Your life? Your family's life? What will it be like? Find out what we experienced. Learn from it and be ready. Transformation is coming. Transformation 2025.
This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You have reached the edge of the world.
Today on Dreamland, we have got one of the greats who's got some absolutely brain-bending stuff to talk about. Dean Radin is one of the best-known researchers in the field of consciousness studies and parapsychology. For more than 40 years, he has explored the boundaries of the mind, investigating phenomena such as intuition, telepathy, mind-matter interaction, and a larger question of what consciousness really is and how far it extends. And we're going to be talking about things like why it is that certain people seem to have psychic abilities and others don't. Dean has made some remarkable discoveries in this direction. Also, his new book, The Science of Magic, one of the most important things we can do is to open our minds to our own possibilities. And we live in a society that is telling us constantly, you don't have any possibilities. Well, I think Dean Radin would argue with that, and we're going to talk about that too. He began his academic training as a violinist, amazingly enough, a classical violinist. He shifted to science. He earned degrees in electrical engineering and a doctorate in psychology. His early career included work at prestigious institutions such as Bell Labs, Princeton, and the University of Edinburgh, where he contributed to foundational research on the nature of consciousness, human performance, and anomalous perception. Since the 1990s, Dean has served as chief scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, IONS, which was organized by a wonderful man. I think I had him on Coast to Coast AM years ago,
Edgar Mitchell, who was also a friend. And so he has led experiments exploring everything from the effects of intention on physical systems to the possibility that consciousness plays a role at the quantum scale. So, Dean, welcome to Dreamland. I think this is going to be a really exciting show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you again.
Yeah, it has been a bit. I think we've been probably since Real Magic, the last book,
yes,
which I still have on my shelf and refer to often. And the reason I do that is that it's so empowering. All of your, that's what your work is. Your work is a form of empowerment. And what I'm fascinated by is, to begin with, and I've listened to our last show, and we really didn't get into this very much. What brought you here? You started from being a violinist, and then suddenly everything changes, and you're a scientist.
Yeah, I suppose it might look sudden when you're reading a biography, but of course it wasn't. I've always been interested in many, many things. Playing music was from age 5 and until I was around 25 was the primary activity, but I was also interested in math and science and lots of other stuff. So the reason why I transitioned out of music as a career is because I spoke to a number of people in my extended family who were professional musicians, including one who played on Broadway. And every single one of them said, if you can do anything other than playing music, do that instead. Because it's really, really difficult to earn a living, to make a living as a musician. And what they also, they didn't say at the time, but afterwards it became pretty obvious, is that if you are a performing musician, you are also an athlete because you're making your living with your body. It involves your mind as well, of course, but you have to be physically strong and have a lot of stamina to be able to play, like in the case of orchestras, for example, hours per day and then practice above and beyond that. And I'm just have never been physically very strong. So I was started looking when I was in college, what else can I do? Because this would be a very difficult profession for me to pursue. So that's why I transitioned into science and engineering as a career, because it was something I could do basically without having to be an athlete at the same time.
So you moved into science, and then somehow something about your mind and the universe in which we live drew you to the frontier of science. But it didn't draw just anybody. It drew a man with a very good, careful mind to this frontier. Why did you move toward parapsychology and magic and all of those wonderful things? As a scientist, it seems like that's the direction to run from if you want to have a career.
Well, yes, that's a viable statement. If you want a safe, comfortable career, you need to be as conservative as possible. You don't want to push the status quo too much. The reason why I was attracted to psi phenomena is because you can use the tools of science to study these experiences. And I had, even as a preteen, I was reading about the literature in parapsychology and thought, well, that sounds interesting. And it matched what I had also been reading in science fiction and in fairy tales. And people then ask, well, why are you interested in this? And I say, well, why is Harry Potter, one of the book series sold like practically the same as the Bible? I mean, hundreds of millions of books are sold on these kinds of stories because they resonate with children and with adults. So I had the same kind of reaction to it. I'm thinking, oh, these are interesting stories. But I took it to the next step is, I wonder if any of that could actually be true. And so there you start looking at the literature in parapsychology and you learn pretty quickly, there's about a century and a half of literature out there, an enormous literature on people who have taken these things very seriously and figured out ways of testing them. And so when I finally ended up after my doctorate at Bell Labs, I started doing those experiments while at Bell Labs and getting interesting results. And that's pretty much what hooked me, because now I was realizing this is not just a it's not just about reading what other people are doing, but I was able to replicate effects myself, even in the technical environment of Bell Labs. And I thought, well, what could be more interesting than continuing to study these things?
Well, let me ask you this. Do you remember anything specific that stood out that caused the transition at Bell Labs that really
Yes.
captured your imagination?
Yes. So I talk about this in my latest book.
I
As,
know it. That's why I asked the question.
yeah. So this is where my ontological shock happened. And it was because one of the things that we were interested in at the labs was why do triply redundant computers fail? Which is very important in any kind of technical organization where you're creating systems that are designed specifically not to fail. And in the Bell system at the time, and it's still true today, when you pick up a phone and you place a call somewhere else, you expect to get a dial tone instantly, and you expect the call to connect anywhere in the world within a couple of seconds. And when you know what's necessary for that to happen, it is astonishing that it works as well as it does, and it is so reliable. I mean, most people don't give a second thought as to how it is that you can pick up a cell phone and call anybody in the world in seconds. What's required? Well, one of the things that's required even back then was a computer network system that was extremely robust. And so every so often it would fail. Now, there were ways of getting around the fail, so the consumer didn't know that, like backroom things that the computers were doing, but sometimes that would fail too. And so this is less common today, but it was fairly common 30, 40 years ago that you'd pick up the phone, you got a fast busy, and it would not connect to anything. And so we wanted to figure out why is that happening? So you do a detailed investigation of why machines fail when they're not supposed to fail. And you can figure it out about 95% of the time. But there's always like 5% left over, and you never know why did this thing not work? So I thought, well, I've been reading about these studies in psychokinetic effects in the parapsychology literature, and I thought, well, maybe there's some kind of mind-matter interaction thing going on. So I took advantage of business trips, and I visited the Mind Science Foundation in San Antonio, Texas, where we had physicist Helmut Schmidt, who is the primary person studying psychokinetic effects at the time in the United States. And so I was very impressed with what I saw that he had developed, and he very kindly loaned me one of his random number generators that he had developed. I took it back to Bell Labs. I started using it on myself and my colleagues. And after something like two dozen experiments, the overall odds against chance was something like 20,000 to one for the results that we were seeing. So I was quite impressed by that, because what it means is, in this particular case, the target was radioactive decay latencies. So that's part of the weak nuclear force. That presumably, from any conventional explanation, that should not be possible for the mind to influence radioactive decay rates, but that is what was happening in these experiments, to a very far from chance result. And so it took a couple of years of continuing to do those experiments for me to reconcile everything that I had been taught as an engineer and as a scientist about the way the world works, as compared to this experiment, which I had read about before, but I'm not sure I believed it, to now seeing that it actually did work. And so, as I explain in the book, it took a while to figure out how can I understand from a materialistic perspective, which is how all scientists are trained, how come the mind is able to do something that transcends that? That's what hooked me. So I was still at Bell Labs, but I figured if there's any way I can continue to do this kind of research. Well, that sounds way more interesting than making a better telephone. So that's
Yeah,
why,
I can see that.
yeah. So that's why I switched.
Well, that's a really, really provocative and interesting reason. And I want to move on now. We're going to take a brief break, and then I'm going to move on into a paper that you published in the Journal of Science and Healing in, I believe, 2021 or 2022, with was it Waba, Betsy Waba? Yeah.
Yeah, Helene Wabe. She,
Helene Wabe. Okay, well,
yeah.
I've certainly fractured her name.
Yeah.
In any case, and others, and it's absolutely fascinating, folks. You'll really be interested in this. We'll be right back. We're talking to Dean Radin. He has been at the IONS, the Institute for Noetic Sciences, for 40 years at least, and maybe more. But maybe we don't want to admit to more. I don't know.
No, it's only 24 years at this
Oh,
point.
24 years. Well, you're how wonderful. You've been studying this for longer, though. You didn't land at
Yes.
IONS,
Yeah.
just out of Bell Labs. Okay. Now, in 2021, he published a paper that really fascinated me. There is a sort of a summary of it called "Do Psychic Abilities Run in Families?" in on the IONS Institute's website right now, and it's a first of its kind comparing the genetics of people with psychic abilities and those without. The team screened over 3,000 volunteers worldwide and selected a group of 13 people who not only claimed psychic abilities themselves, but reported it in their families. And let's take it from there, Dean. You have got this group. What do you then do?
Well, we tested people who are candidates to vet that they actually had some talent. So it's not simply that they made these claims, but they seemed to actually have some psychic talent. And then we found matched controls, which means the same gender and age and race, if we could do that. So we were able to do that. So we had same number of people who were psychic from psychic families and people who never had anything psychic happen and no one in their family ever did. So this is a classic way that you do for genetic testing to see if traits that people display, like talents, have a genetic basis. And so then we got the DNA from each person. They give a cheek swab and send it in the usual way. And then we sequence the genome to look at their DNA. And so the idea is that we know from many other studies that especially when it comes to talent, that a large percentage of talent can be traced to a genetic basis. I mean, it's not 100%, it's something like in some cases maybe 40% of somebody's talent can be traced to a genetic basis. And we figured that while psychic phenomena is not usually thought of as a talent, it's quite clear that some people are more talented in that domain than others. And so the experiment then did a what's called a bioinformatics analysis, looking at the psychic cases against the controls and their DNA to see if there are any differences. And we found a difference. A significant difference. We had originally thought that it would be in the exome as opposed to the intron sequence. And so what that is referring to is the human genome has billions of base pairs in it. These are molecules that put together create DNA. So there are billions of combinations, but only about 50,000 of these are protein or genes that produce proteins. So our body is made up of proteins. And so 95% or more of the DNA didn't appear to do anything, which for a long time it was called junk DNA. They thought it was like glue that held it together or something. Well, then it was discovered that the protein developing part of the DNA is the exome. The intron is the parts between those. So it's the intron between exomes. So most of DNA is this intron sequence. Well, what we found that was different between the psychics and non-psychics was the intron sequence. Today we would call that an epigenetic part of the DNA. So it's not the genes, it's the epigenes, which are essentially molecular switches that turn genes on and off. And so it's something different about the people who were psychic from psychic families in the intron sequence. So
Now, oh, go, no, go ahead.
that we originally thought then that the talented psychics would be the mutants. There would be something different in them, whether it's intron or exome, some aspect of the DNA would be different. We actually found the opposite. That we found that the psychics were pretty close to what we call the wild type. That's the average human. And there's lots of little mutations in everyone. That's why we're all a little bit different. But there's considered a wild type person. That's the jargon used in genetics to indicate a quote normal person, not mutation. It was the controls who were the mutants. The controls had this strange intron sequence. And so our interpretation of it then was the average person probably has some psychic talent. It's an unusual set of people that don't have any psychic talent at all. And when you look at the actual experimental data, that conforms to what we see because, for example, we do a telepathy test. Most of those tests involve unselected college sophomores who are doing the experiments at a university for credit. And they don't even talk about telepathy. They may never have reported telepathy, and yet they can get interesting results in the experiment. That says that from a population perspective, that most people have the capacity to be psychic. Whether it's expressed or not is another issue. But nevertheless, most people, whereas a small percentage of people do not have psychic experiences, and from their perspective, all of these other people who talk about these strange experiences, it would be considered nuts because it's not part of their own experience. So
Right.
they would interpret it as, I don't know what they're talking about, but it never happened to me. But again, that's a minority.
Well, you know what's interesting about this? Well, there are a number of things, obviously. I think it's a potential breakthrough study if you can follow it up more, as the skeptical comment would be, well, it's such a small sample,
Yes.
but you've got to get, everything depends on money, folks. So if you're a billionaire out there listening to this, and I know there are some who do, give me a holler, and because Dean and his team could really use some significant funding to get this on the road again. Let me ask you this: have you funded or projected a funding for a follow-up study? Do you, and if so, what do you estimate it might cost?
Well, before I answer that, I want to say we have followed it up. We haven't published it yet.
Ah.
We're like just now polishing the results.
Oh,
And
wow. That's exciting.
yeah, and so again, we find a significant difference. This time, we find a difference in people who have a lot of psychic experiences as compared to people who don't. So we get a second level. Confirmation that what we had originally found is probably true. This time it was with over 100 people, and what we did was go to people who had done 23andMe or Ancestry.com, where you can send them your DNA, and they'll give you a map, your genetic map, and they can match it to family members and where you came from and so on. So we got the genomic data from them, and then had all of those people fill out a questionnaire that asked about different kinds of experiences that they've had, mostly psychic type experiences. And then we did a correlation between the DNA sequences and their experiences. And so something like 200 SNPs, which are little sequences of DNA, significantly correlated with their experiences. And most of them were like around 0.05, so the probability was not very amazing. But one of the SNPs was a probability of 10 to the minus sixth, so 1 in a million of probability that there's a correlation between the experiences that people were talking about, psychic, and an aspect of their DNA. So that shows that there's something interesting going on. And in some respects, this is not that unexpected that there should be something like this, because some people are definitely have more of these experiences than others. I expect that if we found people like you that have even farther out experiences, we would again find some genetic basis for why you have what we can think of as a talent. You have a special sensitivity. And we find when you do studies on more classic medical issues like schizophrenia, very clear medical and genomic differences are found. Those studies made use 10,000 cases with schizophrenia as matched to 10,000 controls. That costs a lot of money. So we're talking millions and millions of dollars for the budgets that are required to do studies at that level. If we had millions of dollars and we applied it to this, we would know with high certainty, first of all, whether there is a genetic basis, of which we think there is. But more importantly, it would tell us whether that genetic basis can be modulated given tools that we have now for doing neuroengineering. And so, related to all of this is one of the other things that I do is I co-founded a genetic engineering company where we're targeting at this point neurodegeneration disorders, things like memory loss and Alzheimer's and dementia. But the same method can be used to potentially augment people to become more psychic if we figured out what that genetic trait was. We would use methods that are temporary, using RNA interference methods. We use intranasal delivery, so it would be easy to take. And our best guess at this point is that once you're given this medication, that the effect of it would come on in about 2 weeks, and it would last for about 2 weeks. So, is this a good thing or a bad thing? Right? We're making ordinary people suddenly psychic. We might be able to take psychics and make them into super psychics. So these are all unknown questions at this point, but the point is that the technology has finally arrived so that we can both find out what sort of constellation of genes are involved in the talent, and then can we use that to actually engineer someone who has that talent? So huge ethical issues involved here, but nevertheless, that's where the technology is.
Yes, huge ethical issues. And also, there is the issue of consciousness, which is, as we both are aware, it lives in the outside. It's not confined to the brain, and therefore we are plugged into something. Now, if we start changing the way the plug works, what happens on the other side? In other words, you make somebody more psychic. There's something out there that is definitely going to be aware of this. I mean, as you know, I live in a world where the non-physical penetrates into the physical literally all the time. This morning is a perfect example. I am meditate at 3 o'clock every morning, about three when I wake up, and this is a demand. It's not something that I just do. If I don't do it, I will be awakened. I slept very heavily tonight because I have a cold. And at 6 o'clock, bang, bang on the bedside table, two loud bangs to wake me up and get me doing the meditation before dawn. But in other words, there was an awareness of my need for sleep, is what I'm saying, and a presence that wanted me to do this as soon as it was possible, given my state of health. Now, this is, I'm talking about something extremely different from the way we think we live, because I'm not alone in here. I'm not alone in this room, in this apartment, in this head, and neither are you. None of us are. So this gets me to another, and I want to circle back, and we're going to take a brief break now, but I want to circle back when we get back to the question of what about the people who don't have this genetic structure? And one of the most interesting things in the pilot study that I have read is the speculation about why some people do not have this, even though most of us do. We'll be right back. We're talking to Dean Radin, his new book, The Science of Magic. Dean is getting the airplane to land. He is getting this to the point that we can all say to ourselves, this is real, and I'm part of it in some way. I matter, and I can do this. It is empowerment. This is, seems to me, the whole thrust of Dean's career is to empower by enabling us to understand the actual scientific realities here. Now, let's go back to the paper, and we're going to spend some time shortly in more detail with some questions about the phenomenal new book. But I want to, you speculate in the pilot study about why it is that some people lack this gene, and I was absolutely fascinated by that. Can you expand on that and tell us exactly what you were talking about?
Yeah, so one of the authors on that paper specialized in the population genetics, which is that not surprisingly, each population group or race will have slightly different genetic basis. So he looked at the intron sequence that we found, and he said, "Well, where do we find this sort of thing, especially when it's missing?" And he saw what he found was that you take the Holy Roman Empire plus or minus one or two countries, and that's where you find this anomaly that we found. And so he said, "Well, what is it about that place that would have suppressed psychic ability?" And then we thought, "Oh, well, these genetic populations are very slow moving. So it would have been something from hundreds and hundreds of years ago, centuries ago." And what happened centuries ago at the Holy Roman Empire, plus or minus a few countries, that would have suppressed these abilities? The answer is the Inquisition. Because the Inquisition was designed by the Catholic Church to get rid of people who weren't very clearly part of the Catholic Church at the time, the Holy Roman Empire, but who were displaying abilities that would, in their time, would be, have been called witchcraft, which today we probably call psychic. So there was a very concerted effort to get rid of people like that, that would have taken that branch of the human tree and pruned it from people who had those abilities. So that's why we think that this particular subset of humanity has been genetically suppressed so that they don't have the same kind of capacities that others do. Now, that would also suggest that there are some places like maybe in Celtic lands where the Druids were, and many other places around the world where there are many people who are known to have superior talent, like in Northern Scotland, the Second Sight. And that may be true, but again, we would need a large amount of money to do a very careful worldwide search for the DNA as compared to these kinds of talents. And I fully expect we will find some places where it's been suppressed and other places where it has been enhanced. And those effects would still be visible today.
You know, that's really incredibly interesting. We're beginning to be able to hold a mirror up to our mysterious selves with this work you're doing. I think it's marvelous. I think it's absolute genius. I don't want to. I just think it's wonderful. Let me put it that way. Now,
Let me address one other issue which you didn't ask, which sounds it sounds like a paradox that I'm studying the aspects of consciousness which are extended beyond the brain. So as though like, what does the brain have to do with it? Well, if you think of the brain as the source of consciousness, you have a problem. And there's a lot of reasons why and probably your audience knows that there's a lot of evidence that says the brain is not all there is when it comes to consciousness. So we use a slightly different model where the brain is something like a radio receiver, the receiver of consciousness. Consciousness is then the way that we perceive it as a human being involves the brain in some respects because all of our cognition and memory and everything are all linked to it. But nevertheless, as a radio, if you use that metaphor, you can go into a radio and soup it up. You can change components in the radio and make it way more sensitive. Just like, we do that all the time. Or a radio can break, and then it can't do certain things. So when somebody has problems like dementia, there are some components in that radio that are failing. So we're looking for ways of fixing that. The same then is true that if you find that there are certain genetic traits which will be reflected in brain structure that make somebody more sensitive to these transcendent aspects of consciousness, and you do a little bit of component changing through the genetic structure, can you make somebody more sensitive psychically? And it looks like the answer is yes.
You know, that you've made reference to that before, and I think it's tremendously promising and interesting. I'm curious as to what can you imagine what you might do physically to m make these changes genetically? What would it be like for the person experiencing this?
Well, there's two questions here. One is, how would you do it? And the second one is, what would it feel like subjectively? So the company that I co-founded has developed a method to do it. It would be an intranasal delivery of RNA edits. And what it does is it goes in, it diffuses through the brain, goes into your nose, diffuses into the brain, and it downregulates certain receptors in the brain. So we're targeting primarily things like memory problems. And so it is known pretty well what causes memory loss. It has to do with hyperactivity in the section of the brain. And so we can downregulate that hyperactivity and restore it back to normal functioning, and the memory comes back. So we know that that is true in animal studies that we've done. And we're at the stage now where we're ready to go into human trials. And we would test it for things like Alzheimer's. So that's the how. The how is at this point not even requiring much science. It's not like basic research. It's a technology at this point. But what it
You
would
know,
feel like, it.
Dean, before we go on to what it would feel like, I would like to interject something here that I and many other people who have had close encounter experiences back in the 80s and 90s, I don't know if it's still true, experienced something being put up their noses. I remember it very well. In fact, it was so provocative that I had an MRI scan done, and they didn't find any. There was a loud cracking noise. I couldn't move. I was in bed when it happened. It was happened in 1989, and the MRI didn't show anything except a sinus polyp, which are pretty ordinary. I mean, they come and go. But here's the thing. And I talked to the doctor about my doctor about it, and he said, "Well, anyone putting something up your nose would never penetrate beyond the sinuses because it would carry debris right into the brain." And I thought to myself, something happened, but I don't know what it was. Now I'm wondering if you're not describing what our strange friends from the beyond have already done to some of us.
Yeah. No, you can definitely put a liquid up the brain, up the nose, which will go to the olfactory bulb, and it will diffuse into the brain if the molecules are small enough. And so we know that our compound will do that. So this is one of the many reasons, for example, if you have an airborne virus that is small enough and you sniff it and goes up your nose, it can get right through this thing called the cribriform plate. and bypass the blood-brain barrier. Because it is true that it's very difficult for blood in the body, which is the usual way that we end up with a cold or something, that it gets into the blood. That very rarely will pass directly into the brain. And the brain is sort of, in quotes, designed to make it difficult to get into the brain, fortunately. But if the molecule is small enough, it will definitely get in there. And so we, for example, there have been lots of studies using ketamine and using insulin and other studies where you spray it up the nose and you can then trace where it goes in the brain. We know exactly where it goes in the frontal lobe, and then it can diffuse elsewhere. So if whatever was being put up your nose was in a liquid form, could also be a powder, but more likely a liquid, with quite small molecules in it, it could very well have been something like a genetic edit. Because now we know how to do this. What was that, 40 years ago or something? We didn't have, not only did we not know what the human genome was, but we had no idea about how you would manipulate it in the first place. Now we do know how to do that. It's only 40 years, which is like nothing in a historical sense. So if you have some sort of intelligence that's way ahead of us, that would have been trivial for them to figure out how to do.
I don't think they are way ahead of us. I think they're somewhat ahead of us. And I think you're probably identifying about the distance in time. It's 30 or 40 years.
Oh, well then, yeah, it's like
And you're
today you could do
catching
that.
up, Dean. I mean, you
Yeah.
might be ahead of them very soon.
Well, this is the leading edge of development of new kinds of medications now, happening now.
It's remarkable. And not only is it a show promise for enhancing psychic abilities, but in many ways, the curing or mitigating the curse of things like Alzheimer's and dementia
Right.
in a population that is becoming physically able to get older and older is so important, so vital, because we're going to have more and more old people. And I'm fortunate in having a phenomenally good memory, and you do too, obviously. And I can tell from your mustache that you're no spring chicken. I won't mention the other signs.
No,
excuse me, folks.
yeah.
In any case, I want to go on now to this extraordinary, to drill down a little bit more into the science of magic, a book that if you don't read it, you're going to be left behind. It's that important. Real Magic, Dean's previous book, was a marvel. And this one, the one that thing that this book does so clearly is that it creates a bridge between what is called enchantment and the powers of intention and consciousness. I think that's a reasonable summary of what we're dealing with here. It's tremendously insightful and powerful and empowering. Now, let's look at consciousness as a field, and it plays a role in shaping reality, a huge role. Maybe it is the origin of reality as we experience it. I want to talk about your ideas about how this relates to magical practice. And I promise a smaller question in the future.
Yeah. Well, it's pretty straightforward that one of the ways that I think about this is psychic phenomena like telepathy and clairvoyance, psychokinesis and so on, are labels that we give to experiences. They're just labels. Leading edge ideas about how do we begin to understand these things shows fairly clearly that the phenomena are not different. The labels explain how the experiences manifest for most people, but they're not that different when you dive a little bit deeper into figuring out what is actually going on. It's all about non-local aspects of consciousness. So we're our Awareness is spread out through space and time. That's essentially it. That awareness still has to be articulated in some way, and we have to be able to perceive it and talk about it and so on. So our language will take the raw experience of this non-local consciousness, and a lot of that is done by the brain. It's done by our, it's influenced by culture, by language, and all kinds of things. And so we end up thinking that telepathy must be quite different than precognition, for example, because it seems quite different. It's not that different. And we know that from laboratory studies. So how do we get hints to suggest how do we begin to understand this? And also, is it real? Well, besides the scientific approach, one way to look at it is look at the yogic literature, look at Catholicism, look at the Kabbalah, look at virtually every kind of religious or spiritual tradition has names for these very same phenomena. So you find names like the siddhis, and in Buddhism you have the iddhis, and in Catholicism you have the charisms, and so on, on and on and on. It's the same kind of phenomena keep popping up. In the modern world, we call it psi. It's psychic. That's what the phenomena are. The Western esoteric tradition, which is where we mainly think about magic, but it's also magic in the East, are again exactly the same phenomena with some elaboration. So the elaborations is what we tend to see in movies. I mean, and super elaborated in superhero movies. But again, the nature of the phenomena are repeated again and again throughout all cultures, all history, including to the present day when people talk about their psychic experiences. And the only relatively new element over the past century is that science has looked at these things and found, yeah, sometimes these actually do exist, not just fantasy. So the connection then with magical practice is, it's almost as though the science of looking at these phenomena is all about figuring out, does it exist, and what are the things that modulate its existence? Whereas magic is, of course they exist, and we know some things about what modulates it, but it's aimed towards pragmatism. These are practices that you would do in order to achieve a certain outcome, as compared to somebody has a spontaneous feeling of telepathy, and they may not think that it could be applied to anything. In the magical world, that is exactly what you're doing. So it's like a balance between basic science and existence questions versus how can I use this stuff? So the magic side is I'm using stuff.
Exactly, it is, and then you get into the methodologies, and how does it work? And you get into rituals and devices, implements, a certain level of chemistry. There's all kinds of things involved. Evocation of spirits, the use of candles, and there's just thousands of different ways of going about the mechanics of it, the physical mechanics of it. What is meaningful here?
Well, so I mentioned something like five or six different practices that are elementary practices used in magic. All of them have certain commonalities. And so some of the commonalities are a degree of attentional focus and the type of intention that is used and whether you believe it in or not. So there's something like five or six different factors like that. That all together, if you optimize all of those factors, it optimizes the likely outcome, the so-called magical outcome, usually in the context of manifestation or enchantment. And there is some evidence from scientific experiments saying that things like the degree of attentional focus makes a difference, and the degree of intentional focus makes a difference, and whether you believe makes a difference, and so on. So there's a matching between what has been magical folklore about what is required to make things work that is matched with outcomes that support that within scientific experiments. So that's kind of the back and forth that I do throughout the book and talking about practices that you can do that are then confirmed or at least supported by what we see in laboratory tests. And by the way, the reason why I added the magical practice part in the book, which is one of the sections of the book, is because one of the primary forms of feedback that I got from the book Real Magic was people saying, okay, I guess I could believe that these things are real. Well, how do I do it? Meaning, how do I do magic? So I felt it was necessary to put a section in the book that said, if you want to do it, these are the steps that you can follow. And that would be doing magic.
Okay, I agree with you, and I of course I've wanted everybody, not everybody, but most people who are especially people who are living kind of on the edge, want to do magic. And I would like to describe to you something that I do, that I started doing in the Gurdjieff Foundation back in 1969, which was by them called the sensing exercise. And this is an exercise where you take your attention and you don't you let your thoughts go and you let them flow and you place your attention on your body. And in those days it was a very important practice in the foundation. It's much less so now, and the foundation is much more intellectual now, and I'm not really directly involved in it anymore for basically for that reason. But over the years, I found myself in 1985, now all these years after I started, and I was doing it daily, suddenly face to face with the visitors, the non-human beings. And I found out over the next 20 years gradually that they had noticed me doing this at my little cabin in the woods in upstate New York. Because it set up a glow that they could see. And they came to investigate and found this guy sitting there in his pajamas in the middle of the night meditating. And they took me out and gave me a working over to see what was going on. Now, subsequently, this has become the link between me and this other level. This is why I referred earlier to being waked up every day, every morning. In what I'm sure you know of as Brahma Muhurta time, the hour and a half before dawn, when the mind is most open. And that actually works right until just the pre-dawn, and then it dissipates. But my question is this, is this a magical practice? Also, is it in magic? Because I can't find this exercise mentioned anywhere else. I wonder if you know.
It is part of a magical tradition, yes. And in fact, it's also one of the obligatory five prayers for Muslims. So Muslims have five obligatory prayers that they must do every day, one of which is pre-dawn, one of which is at dawn, and then midday, and then halfway midday, and then sunset. And there's a number of other prayers that go along with it, but those are the five obligatory prayers in Islamic lore. Not lore, but that's the requirement. So yeah, I mean, with 2 billion Muslims around the world, a lot of people, according to where their sun is, because it's tracking the sun as it goes around the world, there's this kind of a wave of continual meditation tracking the sun. More within the Middle East and maybe Southeast Asia, because there's simply more Muslims there, but nevertheless, everywhere. This
And there's
constant.
never a moment in the in the in the experience of consciousness as relates to mankind that some kind of prayer
Right.
isn't emerging.
Yeah. But that one in particular, this pre-dawn prayer is not uncommon, I think, within it's not just Islam, but there are other practices that find that time, and oftentimes around 3 o'clock in the morning, but that's a physiological thing. Okay, oh, I almost
Right.
always wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and then I eventually fall back to sleep if I'm lucky. But nevertheless, there is some kind of a cycle that's happening all the time. And so your comment that it produces a kind of a glow that can be seen by some non-human something is quite interesting because it suggests that there is never a dark side on the earth.
Right.
There's always a glow everywhere. And it is one of the cautions then about people getting involved in magic or in meditation or in any kind of these practices, because the likelihood that you will become a beacon increases.
Yes.
People pay attention, or something is paying attention.
Well,
So I try to
I'm
put cautions in my section on doing magic, especially if it involves trying to attract non-human intelligences, because you generally you have no idea what it is that you're attracting, and it's dangerous. Minimal, it's dangerous psychologically, unless you have somebody who knows what they're doing, who can keep you safe. So I don't go into the section on theurgy very much, which is our traditional notion of conjuring spirits and that sort of thing, because it really does require expertise. And there's no way in the world that you can get that expertise by reading a book.
When you say expertise, you can't get it by reading a book. I have to ask you how you can get it. Any ideas?
Well, you got forced into it. It's a little bit like taking a psychedelic and getting your mind blasted into the universe. You don't have much control at that point. You were doing something where you may have accidentally attracted something that you didn't do it because you were trying to attract others, but nevertheless,
No,
they showed up. And
I hadn't
so,
the slightest idea they even existed.
right. And so, if you had read a book about this, you'd probably be beforehand, you would be very skeptical and saying, that's ridiculous. Why would that do anything? Well, it took that experience to show you firsthand it's not quite so ridiculous after all. It does happen. Now, it may not happen with everybody because people are different. The nature of your inherent consciousness is different. All kinds of things are different. But nevertheless, for many people, they will have the experience first. And so I would say when people say, where do you go to learn this stuff? I usually recommend places like the Monroe Institute, because with the HemiSync and the workshops that they have, they're very effective in pushing people into pretty seriously altered states. And so
I
I
went
have
to
a
the
story
Monroe
about
Institute.
that too.
I went to the Monroe Institute just before Communion was published, and took a galley of it to Bob Monroe, who was very much alive at the time. And he read it, and he said to me the next morning, "You know, this is going to get you in a lot of trouble, Whitley." I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, you'll find out." And yes, he was right. But I did have remarkable experiences there, and it was recommended to me by friends because at the time we weren't absolutely sure if my experience was physical or if I was being taken out of my body. And I had not faced the fact that I had physical injuries. It took me a while to do that because one of the injuries was, of course, a rape, and it was difficult to face. In any case, there is a line between the physical and the non-physical. We talk about it, about the veil and so forth. Where do you think we're going with that? Because I think we're figuring out how to cross back and forth between here and there, and that you're a huge part of this journey.
Well, I would say that the modern renaissance of psychedelics is playing a big role in this. The way that I see this is by who contacts me and also the Institute because of experiences where they want to get some kind of a grounding on, am I going crazy or is this even possible? Those kinds of questions come up a lot. We're talking about people, very highly placed, influential people in Silicon Valley and in the government and lots of places that you wouldn't immediately come to mind as the people who have these questions. Well, why has it come up? It's because largely either advanced meditation techniques or psychedelics or both. It blasts open your mind and your belief about what is possible based on your personal experience. So where's that veil? The veil is very, very thin. It doesn't take much. I mean, you can take a little bit of psilocybin and it already starts to become visible and you can tear it relatively easy. So my view of this is that the average person, my stereotype of Joe Sixpack on the street, has been pushed by evolution or shaped by evolution over millions of years to not pay attention to that stuff. And so we have lots of distractions which sort of force us into our embodied self and in the physical world, and we have jobs and we have to go here and there and whatever. That's a lot of distraction. And so it makes it more and more difficult for people doing average things to be aware of other dimensions of existence. It doesn't take much more than the right kind of set and setting and a psychedelic to suddenly be completely aware of it. And for many people, it will totally freak them out. I mean, it can make somebody psychotic. And some people do become psychotic as a result of it because it really shatters your worldview. And so my interest in the reason why I talk about science and magic and so on is mainly because it's just a chronic and persistent interest among a lot of people. But I don't push it too hard. I'm trying to stay pretty straight and narrow on the scientific implications of it. Because if you get further out, even by taking workshops where you're getting pushed, either psychedelics or binaural beats or whatever it happens to be, it can be quite disorienting. I mean, disorienting to the point where you become sort of ontologically paralyzed for a while. And I know from your books and the way that you've described it that your experiences were kind of paralyzing for a while because it is so disruptive. So I don't want to produce that in people. I want to kind of calm everybody down and saying, yeah, it's real. It's not going to bother you, probably. And you just want to be careful about it.
Well, on that note, we have reached the end of our time together with Dean Radin. The Science of Magic, an extraordinary, powerful book that takes a step beyond real magic and gets into the practicalities of penetrating this veil. And you know where I think the veil really is, folks? I don't think it's between us and anything. I think the veil is inside us. And this type of empowerment is exactly what we need to find our way to a clear vision of who we really are, where we really are, and what powers we really have. Dean, thank you so much for being with us on Dreamland.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you for listening. Dreamland is brought to you by Unknown Country and its family of subscribers. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our site coordinator is Amy Safrankova. The founder of UnknownCountry.com is Anne Strieber. I'm Whitley Strieber, your host for Dreamland.